This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio. Reading is to the mind what exercise is to the body. The 18th century English writer Joseph Addison said that. Perhaps it's the only thing we remember from Joseph Addison, but it's a great quote, and we want to know how you're getting your mental workout this holiday season. First-time novelists, cookbooks, regional authors, more popular than ever, flying off the shelves at area bookstores. Is that your taste? Perhaps something else. Today we're going to talk to some folks who are intimate with reading, perhaps more so than us. We welcome to our show Nancy Olson, the owner of Quail Ridge Books in Raleigh, Tom Campbell, co-owner of the Regulator Bookshop in Durham, Peter Zane is with us, reviews editor at the Raleigh News and Observer, and your calls at 877-962-9862. What are you reading? What do you recommend? What are you going to buy this Christmas and Hanukkah holiday season? And what do you want to get? 877-962-9862. First of all, let me welcome all my guests, Nancy, Tom,
Peter. Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
Good afternoon.
Nancy, what are people buying these days?
Well, of course, the obvious ones are the Tom Wolfe and the America, but they sell everywhere. They sell nationally in our stores and independent, and Tom, too, I'm sure. We have our own store favorites, and so we have a different type of bestseller list. At the top of that these days is Donald Harrington's book, With. It's a novel set in the rugged Ozark Mountains. And we think it's a rather fable-esque story, starts out rather gritty, and turns into a beautiful story. And Peter, you had that as your book of the year.
Absolutely. It's
good for you.
What'd you think of it, Peter?
It's a terrific novel. He actually is to Arkansas what Faulkner was to Mississippi. He has created this community of Staymore, and this is another one of Harrington's Staymore novels. Our reviewer said that it's a mixture of Lolita meets Swiss Family Robinson. It's a little creepy, but it can be a little creepy in part. There's a main character is a pedophile, but it just expands into a beautiful, beautifully imagined book about nature and about coming of age.
Tom, I'm reading that regional books are more popular this year than they have been in past years. Is that true?
Regional books are always popular at stores like ours. There's this year, Margaret Maron has a new great mystery novel, High Country Fall. Karen Barker's dessert cookbook, Sweet Stuff, Karen Barker's American Desserts, which is a marvelous book, and I know that she's won the James Beard Award, and some people can be put off by someone of that caliber, but this is a book that even you and I could cook some recipes out. I don't know about
if
Peter,
you can read, you
but,
can cook.
Yeah. We could cook some things out of and be successful at.
Well, they're always cookbooks are usually popular this time of year.
Yes, I can read, but I can't cook anymore. My husband does all that, but I love them. But we have such great regional cookbooks now. As Tom said, Maya Angelou's new book called Hallelujah, The Welcome Table, wonderful reminiscences of her family and friends. Jan Karen has a book. She's our perennial bestseller from, used to live in Raleigh, and she has a new cookbook too.
And I guess writers have figured that out, that it's not really the recipes, it's the stories that go with it.
That's right, and they tell stories in their books. Pat Conroy has a new cookbook that's full of stories, and it's so much fun to read.
There's a book that doesn't have any recipes. It's not regional, but On Food and Cooking, The Science and Lore of the Kitchen, Harold McGee. This is the second edition of a book that originally came out 20 years ago. And it talks about, well, I sat down, opened it first to the section on chocolate, of course, and read 15 pages about where chocolate comes from, how it's processed, its history, the chemical transformations it makes, you know, everything. And it's amazing. We sit and eat things, and we have no idea. Well, where did this really come from? How did it get to me? What's white vinegar made from, and how did it get to our table? In this book, you can just sit and read. I don't think there's a recipe in it, but it's fascinating.
Wow,
it's a great book.
There's just for people of a different stripe, there's also a book on vanilla. that does the thing. Yeah. Is that,
vanilla. You know,
gotta be a pamphlet, not a book.
Is that as good for you as chocolate?
No way.
And how about the book on white chocolate? No, we don't know what that
not
is.
Not good.
The
That's not healthy, according to Mrs. Grade.
We may know what white vinegar is, but we'll never know what white chocolate really is. Peter, we're hearing that regional books, cookbooks, are doing pretty well at the locally owned bookshops in our area. What are the publishers in the big houses pushing this holiday season?
Well, what they're pushing is probably the books on the bestseller list, the Dan Browns. There's an illustrated copy of the Da Vinci Code that looks particularly nice. I would say, though, regionally, a few things that people might want to be interested in that aren't cookbooks. Probably one of the very best books of the year was Tim Tyson's book, Blood Done Signed My Name, about a racial murder in Oxford, North Carolina in 1970. It is a combination of history and memoir that is deeply personal and also provides a honest accounting of Southern history. It is a tremendous book, one of the very best books of the year. I'd say another regional book that will be of interest is Scribblers, Stalking the Authors of Appalachia by Stephen Kirk, who's an editor at John F. Blair. It's a blend of memoir and history that touches on the careers of Tom Wolfe, Fred Chappell, and Stephen Kirk, the author, to explore the place of literature in Western North Carolina. It's a truly wonderful book.
We are hearing some of the picks of local bookstore owners, and also Peter Zane is with us from the NNO, and we want to hear from you at 877-962-9862. What are you reading? What do you plan to give? What would you like to get? Eric's on the line from Durham. Hi, Eric.
Hi. I just got out of Borders Bookstore with Chuck Pepero's Fast Food My Way, and I couldn't be more excited.
Wonderful. What's is it what Fast Food My Way?
It's a cookbook by Jacques Pepin, and my wife and I both work very full-time jobs, and I'm looking for cookbooks that will help us take stuff that's in the larder and make something quickly for dinner that's tasty, because we eat way too much fast food. And this book is talking about, you know, if you got a brick of cream cheese and a can of black beans, you can make something.
Yeah, it's the leftover stuff. It's how you how you reconstruct all of the last few days' meals.
And make something that you actually want to eat.
Yeah, well, if you're hungry enough, you know, anything goes. All right, Eric, thanks.
Are there the regular recipes and the supersize in that?
877. And how do we deal with white chocolate? No, we got to leave that alone. 877-962-9862 is the number to call. How are sales this holiday season?
Well, I am becoming optimistic. We have been flat for the last 2 years, but at least flat is better than down. And right now we're running about 3% up from last year's sales in December. So I am very optimistic.
Right. We're doing a little bit better than that. Of course, 2 years ago we had the ice storm in December that wreaked havoc with our Christmas sales and Nancy's too, I'm sure. So it's not hard to get to be up over that.
If we didn't have so many big authors coming in, I think we would be down in sales. We had Tom Wolfe, and of course that's been our best-selling book of the season. And we have Senator Dole coming for her new book about famous inspirational quotations. And this is what literally keeps our sales.
So that really does
up.
Help. Huh?
It does. Yeah. There are so many chain stores in the area now, about 14. And so that means we have to be extremely competitive. And we found out, we conclude that having the authors is what brings new people in. I think we have loyal shoppers who come on a regular basis, but everybody needs to get new readers.
Talk a little bit about the difference between you and the chains. What is it that you do to distinguish yourself beyond that, bringing in authors?
Well, I think, you know, if you walk into our store, especially this time of year, people are coming in and they say, I'm interested in a book for so-and-so. They've read this, this, and this and liked it. What? Give me some ideas. And we have staff and we're out on the sales floor ourselves, and we just love dealing with that kind of situation. And we also can, people will bring up a book and say, well, what have you heard about this? And sometimes we'll say, not very good. You know, and I don't think that in a chain store, you know, if somebody did that, they might lose their job. But, you know, we're selling you know, our experience, and if our experience says, yeah, this book is overhyped, that's what we're going to say.
Let you know.
The big publishers pay co-op advertising money to stores to promote books, and so the chains get a lot of this. It could be $50,000 a title, and that's a big difference. When you walk into a chain, you'll see the big commercial books that they're pushing, and you walk into our store and you don't see that. You see first the upcoming authors and then new and recommended, our own personal staff picks, and so I think that's a big difference.
Some of the revenue comes right from the publishing houses.
Oh yes, yeah. And we get our share of it. It's not that we don't, but an independent store, of course, is going to get a very small slice.
It seems to me, though, that some of the bigness and the supersizing of the publishing industry could be some fallout that helps independents, right? I mean, because there's so much more promotion, does that mean more people are reading than we might expect otherwise?
I can't be that optimistic. Mm. All the figures, studies now are showing that readership is decreasing, particularly among children and young adults. That's where we really feel we have a responsibility to try to increase children's readings.
Yeah, reading. I'm a little bit more optimistic there. Our store is on 9th Street. We have a younger clientele, I think, overall. And I think among people, you know, in their teens and early 20s, reading can be almost a way to set yourself apart from just being a participant of the mass culture. You know, reading is so intimate, so direct, and it's almost an act of rebellion these days to read a book.
We'll find out how that's going on The State of Things, talking today about books and what people are reading, what's hot for the holidays, and what you are reading as well. We're joined by Nancy Olson from Quail Ridge Books in Raleigh, Tom Campbell from the Regulator Bookshop in Durham, and Peter Zane, Book Reviews Editor from the News and Observer in Raleigh, and we're taking your calls at 877-962-9862. Stay with us. Support for The State of Things comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and listeners who support WUNC. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio, talking today about books for the holiday season. Here in the studio are Nancy Olson from Quail Ridge Books in Raleigh, Tom Campbell from the Regulator Bookshop in Durham, and Peter Zane is also with us, the reviews editor for the Raleigh News and Observer. And we are joined now by Jennifer Beach. She's a research librarian at May Memorial Library in Burlington. She's hopefully on the line. She is the coordinator of the Elements Reads program. Jennifer, you there? Okay, she's not there. We're going to get Jennifer to talk about the an effort in Alamance County to get people to read. And just before the break, we were talking about that. Peter, I'd like to talk with you, get your sense of whether, I guess the figures show readership is down. What are you finding? And does that make it more difficult for a reviews editor? Does the newspaper begin to think, well, we need to devote less time to this?
I hope not. Yeah. There was a recent survey that came out. The NEA used census data, I believe, to show that there had been about a 10% decline in the last 10 years of people who said that they had read at least one book for pleasure during the previous year.
So the Harry Potter revolution hasn't really caught?
Well, essentially, you've had a decline in readership that was intensified a little bit by the advent of personal computers.
Yeah.
You didn't have the internet 10 years ago. Mm-hmm. I think that to take some positive news from that, the survey also revealed that reading is the third most popular leisure activity in America, just behind, way behind movies and television, but still well ahead of many other things. The survey also found that 25 million Americans said that they had read a book of poems in the last year, which was larger than the number of people who had gone to museums or jazz concerts and so forth. So I think that while there's no doubt there are signs that should make us worry, we have to keep it in context.
And on the other side, Nancy, you were talking about a study in Germany that shows that really reading is still probably a better bet in terms of learning than some of the high-tech means.
Just read it this morning in the Monitor newspaper, and it said that high use of computer is not helping our students, that the learning is actually going down. The more you use a computer, the more your learning goes down.
We have learned here not to rely on technology. I mean, for instance, suppose you're going to make a call out to a library and you want to get a hold of Jennifer.
Jennifer.
And then the phones break down. But you know what? Eventually you're going to get her back. Jennifer Beach, are you there?
Hello, I can't hear you.
Hi, Jennifer.
Hi, I'm here.
It's nice to talk with you. You are in Burlington, Alamance County. Tell us about the Alamance Reads program. You're a librarian in Burlington, is that right?
That's correct. I'm a reference librarian here in Burlington, and our community is doing our first ever One Book, One Community Reads program, and it'll officially start February 1st. This was a product of our Alamance Friends group. They're a volunteer organization that supports the library. And they decided that this would be a good year to start. And so after many committee meetings and a lot of thought, they offered three books up to the community, and they chose Doug Marlette's The Bridge.
How did you make that choice?
Well, they had several criteria they went through. They wanted a fiction book that was based in North Carolina, both the author and the subject. Mm-hmm. They wanted something that was fun and enjoyable and not controversial for our first book.
No food fights in the library.
No food fights in the library, that's right. they wanted something that would appeal to everyone, devoted readers and non-readers.
So the idea is you get as many people in the community as you can, and you promote this in schools, book clubs, that kind of thing?
That's correct. Yeah. And then we're also going to offer different programs throughout the community for people to come and meet the author and discuss the book.
Right. So you'll have one or two, many discussions, one discussion. How's that work?
Well, we have we found out that there are about 30 different book clubs through Alamance County, and we know there are more, but there's 30 that signed up. And so we're going to do facilitator training for those book clubs and anyone who wants to start a book club to get them towards talking about the book. And then in addition to that, we're going to have three author events where Doug will come and speak, both on the book and then also on his cartoons. He does Kudzu, and he also is an editorial cartoonist.
We know now these ideas. This idea has been done in other communities as well.
That's correct.
Have you checked with them? I mean, what's the fallout from these programs? Because obviously, you want to promote reading. That's part of why you do this. Does it work? Does there carry over once the program ends?
I'm not sure on that. I haven't seen statistics on that. But when we did start all the meetings, there was a lot of research into different community programs, and what we have seen is that communities that do it once do it multiple times. Mm-hmm. Seattle, I think, is where it started, and they are still doing it. Pittsburgh, I think, started 3 or 4 years ago, and they're doing another one this coming year.
Oh. Wake County is going into their third year.
That's right.
After two very successful years of reading.
Right. Durham County is going to be starting a program this coming year as well. And they just brought in Isabel Allende into our community, and we worked with them on that. And that was just a marvelous bringing diverse parts of our community together.
Wonderful.
That's all optimistic, isn't it, Frank?
So there's hope.
There is hope.
There's hope for reading. Well, Jennifer, good luck.
Thank you.
Jennifer Beach is a research librarian at May Memorial Library in Burlington, coordinating the Alamance Reads program. We're taking your calls this hour as we talk about books, 877-962-9862. Tom's on the line from Durham. Hi, Tom.
Dominic.
Hello, Dominic.
Yeah, Dom from Durham.
Oh,
yeah.
We have Tom from Turum.
Okay.
Go figure. Anyway, what you reading?
Something that I picked up at the Regulator, which is called... Letters Home.
Tell us about it.
I picked up at the Regulator on 9th Street, and it's a story about a young fellow in the Army and the letters that he wrote home and how the family is getting along while he was over in the Iraq War there.
How did you hear about it?
At the Regulator. I walked into the Regulator, saw it on the rack, and I picked it up. It's got a picture of him on the cover and stuff, and I looked at it, and I thought it was a great book.
Tell us a little bit about that, Tom. Do you walk into bookstores waiting? I'm trying to get a feel for reading habits and sort of how readers buy.
Well,
what moves their decisions? Do you say, I'm buying a book today, walk in with an open mind? Or
Always with an open mind. But I used to do a lot of reading, but to be honest with you, so many books were so, I don't know, sort of commercial batized babble that I wasn't getting much out of the books. I got out of the reading habit for quite some time. Maybe the internet helped me get out of the reading habit. But you go through a bookstore, you scour, you look for a well-written book, something that's, you know, passionate. And you look at a cover, you pick it up, read a couple of lines, and if it grabs you, you got to go with it.
All right, Tom. Well, thank you very much for your call. Peter Zane at the NNO, this raises a question for me. How is the editing these days, with so much emphasis being placed on promotion and name recognition in the publishing industry? And you can correct me if I'm wrong about that. Are books being as well edited these days as they had been?
The stories you hear are not as well. I can't say that I have noticed a sharp decline, but certainly with the authors that I work with and so forth, it seems that the marketing departments are ever more in charge of what gets published, and the editors are much more really in the jobs of acquiring books than they are in making them work. Can I make one other point? I think Dom just said is crucial, and he talked about getting in the habit of reading. What you find is that if you watch a lot of TV, TV begins to seem normal to you, and you don't realize how bad it is till you stop watching it, and then you put it on, and you can't believe why you ever watched it. The same thing with books. If you get out of the habit of reading books, you can forget how wonderful they are and how relevant even, you know, works of ancient history can be to your understanding, your world, and your life. And what I would suggest to people out there who are not reading is just, you know, make a pledge in the new year to just set aside a half hour 5 days a week. That's all, just a half hour. Carve out a little time for yourself to read a book. And I guarantee you, before long, you'll find that half hour stretching into 45 minutes, an hour, and so forth. But it's got to become a habit. It's very hard to do. You just pick up a book for 10 minutes one day and then don't get back to it again. Everybody's busy. What you have to say to yourself is, if I make the time to do this, it's going to be something that I will enjoy, that will enrich my life, and that will become important to me.
But not to put too fine a point on it, the fact is it's more work to read a book than to watch TV, and that is sort of part of the problem of bringing yourself into this new habit.
You know what? I totally disagree with that. I find that if you're reading a good book, it's not work at all. It's pleasure. I'm not saying there aren't some books that are challenging, but I don't find that what I'm reading, it's work. I don't find that it's exhausting to me at all. I find that I actually get more energy because my mind is stimulated. I find with the TV that the eyes, believe me, I watch TV, don't get me wrong, but I think that that's one of the myths that people think, that reading is hard, that it's work, that it's not a release from your daily toils. And I just think that that's what you say when you're out of the habit of reading and you're not constantly reminded of the pleasure that it brings and the excitement.
That's right. I think the phrase "lost in a book" says a lot here, that you can get drawn into a book to such a degree. And there, you don't get lost in television. You get sucked into television. That's the phrase that comes to mind. You know, you still don't get lost. And you may get lost in a movie, but just for brief periods of time. But if you really resonate with a book, you're just transported into another state of mind, another land.
We are joined now by June Spence, who has published her first novel. We're talking today about books we're reading, what's on our list. So we thought we would turn to a writer as well. And June Spence published her first novel, Change Baby, in September, and she may be changing a baby in about a day or two. Any minute now. So we know if you drop the phone, we know where you're going. But thank you for joining us.
Thanks. I'm glad to be here.
What are you reading, June?
Oh, let's see. I just finished one of my favorite short story writers, Joy Williams, came out with her first collection in like 10 years called Honored Guest. And that was just a... Oh, it was wonderful.
What do you like about her work?
She has the most bizarre, quirky, but exacting kind of voice. Her details are just these exquisite things, and she just is sort of a master of the bizarre exchanges that go on between people. And it was just a wonderful, not having read a short story of hers in quite some time. It was really good to see her again. She had a novel that came out about 3 or 4 years ago that was great, but she's really the master of the short story form, and So that was one. That was one I couldn't wait till Christmas to get. So I went ahead and snagged it.
Very curious about this. As someone at your stage in your career, you've just finished your had your first novel published. Mm-hmm. So, can you read without saying to yourself, "Oh, I could have done better than that"? I mean,
of course not.
Is it? I mean, do you enjoy reading anymore, or is it competitive for you?
I was a reader first, foremost, and always. And so, I mean, my first hope with anything is to just be delighted by the work and to be lost in a book. And that, I don't know, maybe that's harder to do now because you do become a sort of, you're sort of scanning for technique mm-hmm. and you're measuring up someone else's work against right. your own. But I don't know, that can take the background. Maybe the difference is if I read like another debut novelist, I'm a little more.
Well, do you find yourself staying away from those books as a result or not?
I mix it up because mm-hmm. if I read, I mean, I, you know, if it's going to destroy my pleasure in reading, and sometimes it can, but I think that has probably less to do with the actual writing and more to do with, did this book get a lot more attention? More attention than a very recent thing that was sort of a major pride and excitement, but also sort of a pang, was flipping open The New Yorker, and a student of mine, a former student of mine, Anthony Doerr's new book, what's it called?
Can't help you there, Jane.
Anthony Doerr.
Yeah. Uh-huh. He had a wonderful short story collection called The Shell Collector, and then his first novel just came out, and there was the ad
Grace.
For it. Something.
Wait, was that Grace?
Grace.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. But anyway, so you were pretty happy for him?
I was happy for him, but also just,
but you taught him everything he knows.
No, not at all. It's only this guy. Oh, he was so out of the gates when I had him in the class. But so it was like this mixture of delight and great pride, and also just ow.
Yeah.
Where's my New Yorker ad?
Do you mostly read fiction?
Mostly, I'm a lot more nonfiction now, and
really?
I think that may have to do with. When you are writing fiction, because my husband is a nonfiction writer, he reads a little more fiction now. I think you kind of don't want to get too influenced. And reading lots of nonfiction gives me lots of good information and lots of a different kind of style or technique or storytelling, maybe. And it doesn't. I kind of worry a little bit about. I stay away from certain kinds of books that might be too much like what I'm trying to write.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. What are you working on now?
I'm working on another novel. Well, right now I'm waiting for a baby to show up. I will receive another novel soon.
Well, I think we should mention that June's book is quite excellent. And I don't know if people realize that Change Baby refers to a baby that's conceived during a woman's change of life. Uh-huh. So that baby is quite a bit younger than the others in the family. But June, wonderful book, wonderful.
Thank you.
Make a wonderful Christmas present, holiday present.
I'm hoping it'll be closer to Hanukkah.
Yes.
Well, June, I appreciate you talking with us.
Hey.
And I'm glad we made it through the interview. Good luck. June Spence published her first novel, Change Baby, in September and joins us from her home in Raleigh. 877-962-9862 is the number to call if you want to join us. You know, talking about television and the internet, are you finding, Nancy and Tom, that you're having to devote more space to DVD and new media, that kind of thing?
We do not. I look on DVDs as direct competition with reading books, and we made a decision long ago not to carry them. We do carry music. We carry classical and traditional music. That's all we do outside of the book realm.
Yeah, we don't carry them ourselves either, there are plenty of places for folks to get DVDs.
And, well, in fact, we can order them. You could too, and you get quite a good discount on them. So our Reader's Club members still get their discounts.
877-962-9862. Out to Apex and Susan on the line. Hello, Susan.
Hello. I sort of have a ritual that I do with my father each year. He comes to town and. We go on a big book shopping extravaganza. He gives books to everybody in my family every year for Christmas gifts.
Yay!
We've been to Quail Ridge. We go to Barnes & Noble, but we spend hours and spend lots of money. His money.
Yay!
Well, you got and that
it's,
figured out. It's,
so it's a definitely vicarious pleasure for me.
So how many people traipse into the store all at once?
Just he and I.
Oh, just the two of you. I thought the family.
Yeah.
Okay, yeah.
But anyway, he is a retired psychiatrist. He's been retired for a year, very avid reader. And I'm looking for something for him this year that he would like. He's read all the Patrick O'Briens. He loves biographies. He's, very well read. But I was looking maybe for some, if you all have some advice about something that he might like.
I've got the first thing that came to my mind is the new book by Kay Redfield Jamison. She's a psychologist,
yes.
A professor of psychiatry. Her new book is called Exuberance, The Passion for Life.
Okay.
And it's a look at, from a psychologist standpoint, what happens when people are feeling really good. And this is, as she says, something that psychology has largely ignored. It focuses on what happens when people are feeling bad and are out of shape. And so it's just a fascinating, fascinating look at people and at the state of mind of feeling really fine.
Feeling good.
Yeah.
He might like the new George Washington biography, too, by Joseph Ellis, His Excellency. It's gotten great reviews. It is one of our top sellers. And if he likes biographies, that gives you a great insight into the beginning of the country.
Peter, real quickly.
Well, just one other thought might be if he wanted to start on a new, a different series, because the O'Brien series has just ended with the release of 21. The
right.
Flashman books by George MacDonald Fraser.
Okay.
It's absolutely fabulous series. Takes place a little later. The O'Brien Sea books are sort of during the Napoleonic era, and this is a little later, but they're great adventure stories with a wonderful character.
All right, well, I hope that helps, Susan.
That's very good, and I hope to see you all. I'll bring him when he comes into town.
Come on by.
Okay, we've been talking about reading books today. I'd like to thank Nancy Olson, owner of Quail Ridge Books in Raleigh, Tom Campbell, co-owner of the Regulator Bookshop in Durham. Peter Zane is book editor for The News and Observer, and we want to thank June Spence also, author of Change Baby, who joined us by the phone from her home in Raleigh. Just ahead, we'll hear about Burning Coal Theater Company's current production and the masterpieces for sale at the Mabain Auction. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stachow. 2 weeks ago, Jack Bolas, a junior at Chapel Hill High School, came in fifth place in the 5,000 meters race at the Foot Locker South Regional in Charlotte. He covered a distance just over 3 miles in 15 minutes and 1 second. That's a personal best and gives him a berth at the Foot Locker Cross Country National Championships in San Diego this weekend. And we welcome Jack to the show. Hi, Jack.
Hey.
That's a pretty good time. Did you know you were running such a good time?
It hurt a lot.
It hurt?
Yeah, I knew by my mile split, my 2 mile split, that I was faster than I'd run in the past.
You keep track of the time while you're running, or somebody else?
They yell out the mile splits and the 2 mile splits, so you have a general idea of the time you're running.
In a big race like that, do you worry that all the adrenaline is going to get you off to too fast to start?
Yeah, I'm worried. What I'm worried about is that it's going to it'll feel good. I'll have the adrenaline pumping in, so it'll feel good for that first 800 meters. And then afterwards, that adrenaline's just going to drain away, and you're going to be left with just you and your legs and nothing special. And so, and then it becomes like a completely different race at that point. So that's scary, I guess.
So do you find yourself trying to control yourself going out, or do you feel, nope, man, if this is the adrenaline, I'm going to ride it out, and I'm just not going to hit that?
I don't want to go out too fast, but in a race like Foot Locker, you have to take it mile by mile, as opposed to I'm worried about if I'm going to have energy for the rest of the race.
I see. So you really have to worry about the pack. How long does the pack stay together?
There was a good group of like the top 15 was through the first mile and started spread out. By the end, it was a matter of seconds between places within the top 12 at the end of the race. So it was like one slip up will lose you like a place.
Yeah. And I gather from what you're saying that by that first mile, mile and a half, you better have your position established.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I was top 20 in that first 400 meters. It's just a straight sprint at the beginning of the race. And then by the mile, I was, I think, 12th, 13th, 14th, right around there, which is exactly what my coach told me to do.
Well, your coach is here, Ron Wilson. Welcome to the program.
That's okay.
Tell me, how do you coach runners, especially distance runners?
I set up in my head and on paper a program for races with the kids that are capable of. Now, there's a difference because some of the kids, you just tell them to get out and go as fast as they can for as long as they can because they can't strategize, mm-hmm. because they can't play. With somebody like Jack and a couple of the other kids, you can say to them, do this at this point, and they can either come close to pulling it off or pull it off, and that's going to give them a better chance down as they go to the end of the race.
So, Jack, what do you do to prepare for the Nationals?
Run lots of easy days.
What's an easy day?
Just like 45 minutes, just taking it easy. Because there's no point in doing a lot of work between regionals and nationals because you probably won't feel the benefit all that much in that short amount of time.
So, Jack, what are your chances here?
I'm going for, Olsen said, 14th through 22nd place. So my chances for 14th through 22nd place are hopefully high.
How many kids run in the nationals?
32.
Wow. Very nice. Well, good luck.
Thank you.
Jack Bolas is a junior at Chapel Hill High School. His coach is Ron Olson. Jack is running in the 5,000 meters at the Foot Locker Cross Country Championships National Finals in San Diego this weekend. The Burning Coal Theater Company in Raleigh currently has two plays in repertory, Safe House, written by playwright Lydia Strike, and 90 in 90 by Jerome Oster. We've invited the company's founding artistic director, Jerome Davis, with us to tell us a little bit about these productions. Jerry, thank you.
Thank you for having me.
One of these plays, Safe House, is about the encroachment of fascism on personal relationships. How did the play come to your attention?
Well, Jody McAuliffe, who's a professor of theater studies at Duke University, came to me and said, I have a play that I'm interested in producing, and I can't find anyone to produce it. And I was already, my curiosity was piqued, but I certainly had known Jody for years and known of her reputation as an extraordinary theater artist. And so I basically said yes, and I'm happy that I did. It's a wonderful piece of writing.
Interesting. It sort of resonates a bit with Philip Roth's latest work.
That's right.
We seem to be interested in things having to do with that way of life. Tell us a little bit. You've got two plays now in rep. How does that work?
Well, it's, we run the plays on alternate days. Mm-hmm. They have certain elements that are compatible for both of them. The lighting design is more or less interchangeable. The set requires some changeover, but it's basically the same. And we have two different casts. And it's the first time we've done that. We've done other plays that were long, and we would divide them up into two parts, like All the King's Men last year, Adrian Halt's production. But this year, Burning Coal decided to take on two new plays, and we're happy that we did. It's been a tremendous success for us so far.
I saw Moon Over Buffalo a few weeks ago, which is a play about backstage, two plays, and they all get confused. Anyway, right. It's a great romp, but I want to talk more about what's going on with Burning Coal. You've been around, this is your eighth season now, right?
Yes, sir. It seems like about 3 days to me, but we have been here 8 years.
That's great. Where does the name come from?
Well, it's actually a biblical quote. Romans 12:20 says, if your enemy is hungry, feed him. If he's thirsty, give him drink. To do so will be like pouring burning coals upon his head. And we thought the idea of good works through sort of an activist means was a very positive idea. And it also resonates and conjures a gritty feel. And that's something that's very important to us. At Burning Coal, we're not a slick company. We're not a smooth company, but we think gritty is a good word to apply to us.
Gritty? How else would you describe your mission?
Well, we want to do literate work. We're interested. I was listening to your last segment about books, and I wanted to dive into the conversation several times. We're very interested in the written word. We think it's the thing that separates us from all the other beasts on the earth, and if we have a value, it's our focus on literate material.
Well, if I can pull a few themes together over the last few weeks, we had Tom Wolfe on here, author of the phrase, the novel is dead. We're talking about a decline in reading. What's the picture like for the theater going public?
Well, they say that the theater is a dying art form, but they've been saying that for 2,000 years. So we call it something like the magnificent invalid, perpetual naturally on its last legs, but never quite dies. And I think there's a good reason for that, and that is that the theater creates a relationship with the audience that no other medium, certainly not film or television, is capable of doing. And that's something, again, that's very important to us. When you come to one of our shows, you won't know where the stage will be from one show to the next, let alone where you're going to be sitting. We think that's an important part of things. We like to keep our audiences guessing.
What's the trend these days? Certainly we see in books, in publishing, politics and spirituality seem to be two of the big themes. Is the same happening in the theater world?
Well, no, the musical continues to rear its ugly head, but in certain circles, politics is certainly, getting a toe in the door. We're for instance, contemplating a play next season called A New War, which is a satire by Massachusetts playwright Gip Hoppe about the way cable news networks covered the war on Iraq. And it's about the funniest thing I've read in the last decade or so. So I hope we can get the rights to it.
You're going to get the tears out of our eyes with that one?
We might get some people walking out the door too, but we think it'll be worth it.
But I want to get back to this idea of having two plays going on at the same time. What's the timeline for putting the plays together and suddenly it's crunch time? They're all... happen at the same time.
That's right. It starts, usually a play starts about 2 years before it actually is performed. And we start by trying to get the rights. In the case of new plays, it can be more cumbersome because you have to deal with agents and not just Samuel French or dramatists who normally sort of by rote issue rights or not. But with agents, there's more dickering to be done. And then you do production meetings and you have casting sessions and you get to that point where everything. We call it Tech Week or Hell Week, if you'll pardon the French. And we then everything collides. And on opening night, we know pretty much whether we've done something right or not. And this time I think we have.
Great. Well, best of luck to you.
Thank you very much. We appreciate it.
Speaking with Jerome Davis, Artistic Director of the Burning Coal Theater Company, the play Safe House and 9090. Both plays are playing at the BTI Center in Raleigh until December 19th. Every Friday evening at the Mebane Antique Auction Gallery, there is a sale. So what makes tomorrow night so different? Well, this auction includes a portrait by John Singer Sargent and a Martin Johnson Head landscape, as well as an unsigned portrait from the Pan American Exhibition of 1901. John Lambert is the owner and auctioneer of the Mebane Antique Auction Gallery and joins us on the phone from Mebane. Hello, John.
Yes, how are you doing today?
I'm doing fine, thank you. Where did you get the Sargent portrait?
The Sargent came out of a private estate in the western part of North Carolina. I had been in the family for around 60 years, and it's the first time it surfaced.
And how do you find out about something like that? They contact you?
Yes, they contact us. We represent families throughout North Carolina, and it's sort of like a chain reaction when we sell things of great value in the past. People find out about us from the website and through word of mouth.
What about the landscape?
The landscape of the Martin Johnson Head came out of a private collection out of Greensboro, North Carolina.
Mm-hmm. And same thing, they got in touch with you?
Correct.
Yes. How did you get into auctioning?
Well, I got into auctioning in 1991. My grandfather done all the estate sales in the area in Alamance County and Orange County area back in the 1940s and 50s. And I was always interested in antiques, and I got my first book on antiques when I was 9 years old and been studying ever since. And I've seen the auctioneering business growing a lot in the late 80s, and when I decided to open up in 1991.
How do you decide when it's time to go into the auction business as opposed to just having an antique shop on the side of the road or something?
Well, I enjoy dealing directly with the families. The pieces we discover are fresh to the market, where the antique shop owners and keepers normally go out to the auctions and to other markets to get their material. We get things directly from the family home, and it's like making a discovery. And it generates a lot of excitement throughout the antique community, where people would like to come to the auction and see what we discovered this week.
Are people often of a mixed mind? Do they find it difficult to part with their treasures?
Yes, there's a lot of things that do stay in the family homes. Normally, we recommend if there's family members that have things have meaning to them or sentimental attachments, we always recommend keeping them. Don't make a sudden decision to put them in the auction. Sometimes it takes them 6 months, a year, after there's a death in the family to decide where their item's going to go. And we do all the research for them and provide pre-auction estimates to make them feel comfortable before they sign the contract.
You ever get out to a place and find that somebody's changed their mind when you got there?
It's happened a couple times, and it's and we always recommend the families to keep the items that mean a lot to mm-hmm. them. And we've had other times we've seen where we was late getting to the estate where they was not aware of what the quality of antiques they have there, and they was fixing to go into a yard sale.
Wow.
And we've made a lot of discoveries that way.
How about some family squabbles? You get there and they're still arguing?
No, that never happens. Yeah. I try to have everything settled prior to my arrival.
How about placing a value on these things? Does the sort of the direction of the economy have much to do with the antique market?
I think at this time now, people are going away from the stock market and are paying more attention to fine art as an investment. We're seeing more and more of that in the last 2 years.
What's your specialty?
My specialty is probably North Carolina art pottery and utilitarian ware, Southern furniture, silver, Southern folk art, mm-hmm. Toys, and country store advertising items.
Wow. Now, I understand you have an unsigned portrait. Tell us about that.
Yeah, it's generated a lot of excitement. This piece was discovered in Cambridge, Maryland, directly from an estate. Has never been cleaned, has a lot of labels on the back, and I have in the last 2 weeks discovered that the frame is mid-18th century, but the painting was painted probably around 1890 to 1900. It's a very important painting, we feel like. We haven't got the artist name documented yet, but it's being looked up as we speak. It's got a catalog number where it was exhibited in 1901 in Buffalo.
Hmm.
And there's a catalog that I have an expert in that area looking into as we speak.
So is that from the Pan American exhibition up there?
Correct, yes.
Wow. So once you get that verified, then you'll have an announcement to
make. Well, I think a few of the experts that already flew in from out of state already know who it is, but they're going to keep that to themselves until we get it auctioned.
All right. Well,
we're researching as we speak.
Where does most of your business come from?
Well, we have weekly antique auctions here. And most of the clientele is in the Piedmont Triad of North Carolina. And we do have people that travel from Virginia as well as South Carolina on a weekly basis to attend our regular Friday night auctions.
All right. You have some items, I understand, from the George Mason estate?
Yes, we're real excited about that. We're working with a family here in Burlington, a direct descendant of George Mason. We're selling her George Mason's granddaughter's tea service that she was presented to her in 1849. We're real excited about that. We've had three clients fly in to just view this piece, and it's a historical piece of silver.
Right.
And also we have George Mason's son, Captain John Mason, circa 1824, his coin silver mug. And it was made by the premier silversmith, A.E. Warner, out of Baltimore.
Wow. Just briefly, John, why would somebody choose you over, say, a Christie's or a Sotheby's?
In the last 10 years, the regional auction houses throughout the country has got recognized, and Sotheby's and Christie's, I'm trying to think how I can explain this to you. We do not charge a buyer's premium.
Oh, so
we do extensive advertising just as much as Sotheby's and Christie's. They have a great mailing list.
All right.
And you know, things that I would say 500,000 and up need to go to Sotheby's and Christie's.
All right, John Lambert, thank you very much.
Okay.
Owner and auctioneer of the Mebane Antique Auction Gallery. An important annual Americana auction takes place tomorrow at 1 o'clock in Mebane. That's the state of things for today. You can send us an email at wunc.org. Support for the state of things comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. I'm Frank Stachow.